Channel 2 over. At the first is the Mockingbird. I tried to tape the Mockingbird. And then the rest of it is the visit with Carl at bedtime on Sunday, the 1st of September, 74. Channel 2 over and beginning of the visit with Carl at bedtime. This long, very pleasant, and high-spirited visit this Monday at bedtime, the 1st of September, 74. Channel 2 over and beginning the visit with Carl at bedtime this Sunday, the 1st of September, 74.
Never know who's here.
No.
Hello.
Yeah, right. Wandering. Yeah. Wandering spirit.
Well, I come when I'm least expected.
I was out there coming up from the trailer and I splashed my
eye
right in his eye.
I heard something come up. I thought it was somebody with a lost puppet.
Well, it's the way it is right at the moment. I see you did. You got 5 pounds of honey from Mr. Roski. Ross.
Is his name on it?
Rosquire. Ross.
Rye Ross.
Read the label at home on the honey we got a week ago.
Goldberry and palmetto.
Now Florence said she tasted that palmetto. She got a jar of it for Roberta Pierce and she said it was very, very delicious. Thanks. Very delicious. What else did you get at the...
Well, I'm glad you're nice and lively, because I've been proofreading all day, and I'm just...
You just turned off for the day?
I turned off to start with. I don't like to do that.
Well,
proofread once and then let it go at that.
Are you proofreading your own material or somebody else's? Is that right?
Oh, yes. Some of them, that's all they do, proofread. You know, they get pretty good if that's all you did, isn't it?
There again, it all depends on how much enthusiasm you bring to the job. If they don't bring any more than you do, they wouldn't be very fine. Any more than you appear to be bringing at the moment.
Prospective proofreader not long ago, and this one said, well, you haven't double spaced it, and I can't write in where the misspelled words are. And the guy says, hell, I can go over it and correct the spelling. I want.
What you want is that you want an editor.
I want an editor.
Yeah, you don't want a proofreader. You want an editor. Yeah.
Well, I tell you.
Now you're beginning to see the problem.
I get a book. I tell you what I'll do. I just get a book and I say, well, just do mine just like this. You know, some of the nice books are published right coming. You know, Eric Hoffman came out in a little bitty book, just close print and all. I don't have a copy of that. I have a copy of Eric Hoffman somewhere.
Just writing a book is the least problem.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the least problem. Right. Any fool can write a book.
Trying to get a publisher to print it so it can be read. Huh?
It looks like any fool does write one, too. All the books are written.
I really got something going. Florence is going to get, she's going to be annoyed. It's seagull being nettled. Do you know where?
Oh, God.
I know what you're telling.
I'm
not talking about you. Going to Carl. You remember when Mary Liza got that fit on her to leave the ranch and work in town?
Yeah.
And if Florence had paid her double wages, what they paid in town, she still would have gone, don't you think? She just had the madness.
Sure she would. Sure she would.
Yeah. Well... We've been knocking around with a woman she's been working with all this time.
And we didn't know it.
And mm-hmm. I just wanted to go find out if Florence knew who realizes that
name,
lady.
Her name is Smith.
Smith?
Mm-hmm.
Well, some might pronounce it that way. But anyhow.
Murray?
Is that right?
Murray, is that the name?
Well, that might be one of the names. It's not... That's mine.
Murray Smith?
Is that right?
Yeah. Murray Smith. Sounds to me like that's the name.
Well, maybe
we've already been nettled. She's already been nettled, but she doesn't know it.
She has.
Yeah.
That woman is not Myrtle Smith that I'm thinking about. It's somebody else. She's about as dull as any person I ever saw. Leaving Florence and the ranch and you all out there.
I know, can you imagine?
Work with that blockhead. It's just outrageous.
He just went to my lines and would could stand it.
Well,
that's probably, I don't know how y'all interpret that from a literary point of view, but it's kind of, I think I can... It only confirms how dumb Liza is.
Yeah.
Tell me, is that a storyline? I mean, could you make a story out of that?
I don't make stories. Yeah. I just tell the truth. That's all I do. Well, I lie, but I do it in a factual way. Let me tell you.
I don't know why that calls to mind a comment by one of the professional golfers just two or three days ago who was leading the pack when he shouldn't have been. Or, well, it was somebody else, maybe. It wasn't winning. Should have won and didn't. Said victory and defeat are both imposters and they should be treated the same. Quoting somebody that he didn't know. I don't know who originated that, but I think that's kind of cute.
Victory and defeat.
Yeah.
I've just been reading it. Out of the North African War with Rommel, and about Rommel, written by a German author, and Rommel was of course very disturbed because everybody thought he should win all the time. He expressed it that no one knows the weaknesses of any more than the fellow that's in the seat, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that everybody thinks you should win, and that when you lose, that they blame it on malicious intent, you know.
Yeah.
How hard it was to live with the defeat. Well, Florence got a phone call through the answering service yesterday morning, I think. Asking her to call, I think the name was Murray Smith, Mrs. Murray Smith, to talk to her about a girl, a maid that used to work for her.
Oh, that's the way you got Murray Smith.
Oh.
And that was Merlina.
Well, we don't know who the maid was. And Florence says, I don't know what maid it was. She says, I haven't had a maid for in the recent 2 or 3 years. She says she wouldn't know who it was, except a couple of people she'd had to only worked a few days. She had to with some. What'd she call Idle May? Ida May, we could call her Idle May. Worked a few weeks and she had it. One woman came 2 weeks just recently. Her name was Rosa. She's from New Jersey. She's a cook by trade. Very vigorous and ambitious, a very vigorous sort of woman. She came the first day and worked the vacuum cleaner, and the next week she came, and then the first week Florence says, don't wax any of the furniture, you know? So Florence left her in the house on the second trip around, and she promptly got a all darn can of wax and went and waxed all the furniture. We have we had furniture redone, you know,
uh-huh.
And it has a non-gloss
mm-hmm.
finish on it that we like.
Don't want
it glossed. We want uh-huh. it. I mean, she went over the mantle and the whole. Why?
She didn't like her old doll finish.
I guess not. Why? God, I just—it's like setting fire to the place, as far as I'm concerned. Infuriates me. That's a sin. Sin.
Well, you just have no control over.
Oh, anything.
Yeah, not if you leave him in the house alone. Yeah,
no.
Yeah. Hmm?
You tell him no, not to do it.
Be sure. What is that instrument there? Well, it looks like a TV, but it looks like it's an uncommon looking TV.
Oh, it's just a little TV.
The one behind it, contact.
Hi, Duchess. This one here won't work, so I just didn't. I just set this in front of it. So, just laziness.
Well, I see. Is that a clock? What is that?
Yes.
Numbers on there.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Clock, but I never keep it going. So I don't know what time it is. And you can set it and it'll come on, you see. But I don't do that.
With all those gadgets.
So.
Well, I'm down to about 1 hour a week on the TV or less, so I don't know what goes on much.
What hour?
Any, I mean, total viewing time per week is about less than an hour.
Any particular hour?
Well, the only thing I'd tune on purpose would be the Masterpiece Theater. Or the only thing I'd tune in person.
I like that.
I had been wanting to see professional golf on the air, and I turned it on for 15 minutes or a half hour this evening. It's the first time. Year, I guess, that I've seen the golf. I think professional golf is a very interesting phenomenon, I think. Has the same actors all the time, but they change their, of course, they challenge each other all the time, but I think what's most important about the phenomenon is that the golfers challenge themselves. See, I think it's a great. It's no life and death
mm-hmm.
Throws exactly, except the challenges are very dramatic.
I don't know that.
The only sport that I would even read the score about.
I feel sort of shabby right now. Watch the tennis sport, but I just don't get around to it.
Well, 2 years ago, I had just simply rearranged my priorities, and sports is the very last in line. So.
Yeah.
It's collegiate sports. It's
mm-hmm.
football games.
You know,
I don't ever plan to go to another football game in my entire life.
Huh?
I don't plan to go to another football game in my entire life.
Well, it's nice to go to all those things. The sports is almost like going to church.
you listen to one program in sports, and there's so much they have to tell you, they never get through, you see. And one sport leads into another, and one game leads into another, one team leads into another. You see, it's endless. It's mm-hmm. an endless thing. And you go to church, and you say, well, I'm going to church today, Sunday. And then they'll ask you, well, you didn't see you at Sunday school. Okay, next time you say, well, I'll just go to Sunday school today. And church, and they say, well, I didn't see you at the prayer meeting. and you see, if they see you at the prayer meeting, then they didn't see you somewhere else. And it's an interminable thing until sinful. And you just can't please anybody. You'd be in worse shape, I'd be in worse shape, you see, being a member of the church and go to church 1 hour a week.
Yes, sir. But you only made one misinterpretation there. You're really going to please yourself and not anybody else.
Well, and then the sports, you see, sports and fishing and all those things, they just little won't do.
Well, that's exactly right. The conclusion is that when the sport runs you, then it's not a hobby. When it runs you instead of you, the hobby.
Well, it'll run you.
I know.
I mean, you can't avoid it.
Oh, yes, you can.
Temptation, you see.
Yes, sir. I've got projects that you wouldn't believe, or you would believe. Say, I got projects galore. And Florence said, why don't you finish it? I tell Florence, I don't have to finish it.
Yeah.
The minute I get it all finished, I won't have anything to do.
Uh-huh.
And I'll do just whatever pleases me next. And
you've got a pretty good size shed in the back there.
Absolutely.
I didn't realize you had all that.
I can do anything I want anytime I want to do it.
What'd Brent say? Careful, adults at play?
Yeah.
That really
he's only just ready to sort of mature a little, and it's coming at a very good time with Dow out of the house. We were amused this evening. We get this call, the phone rings, and the operator on the line, and she didn't sound very businesslike, you know. She said, is this 378-9073? And I said, yes. And she said, well, Dow Van Arnum in Jefferson City, Tennessee. You know, and I said, you know, this is a kind of a funny way to myself real quick. This is a funny way to come on with a collect call. And I says, he's calling collect. And she says, no, he wants to call another number in Tennessee and charge it to this number. I said, well, okay. So Dow is up in Jefferson City, Tennessee. Well, I don't know who in the world is going to call unless it's his distant aunt and by Florence's in-laws, you know, way around.
They called you down here.
Yeah, calls, charge the long-distance call to home. Scoundrel. He couldn't hang up. Can't imagine him having to call anywhere that costs more than 35 cents.
And he drove himself up.
Yeah, he left last Saturday, a week ago Saturday. All by himself. Stayed overnight in Atlanta with a friend of Florence's and then took off for that. And then went on to Jefferson City on Sunday.
Carl, when you travel, what do you care for money? Master charge?
Yeah, I carry a Master charge and Bank America card, and that's all. And I have a standard card, but I seldom use it because almost everybody at the place takes. We went to Tennessee and back, and I think there was one place that wouldn't take the Master charge. I think it was a standard station that won the standard card, but most of them will take. Almost all of them will take a Master charge. And I take cash. I've never purchased a traveler's check in my life.
You take cash?
I don't take very much, but I take some. But I I keep my hand on my pocketbook all the time.
Well, you know, it's got to where you can't write checks. Out of state, out of town checks.
Oh, heavens, you can't hardly get a check. You know, you can't get a check cashed at any bank except one that you have an account in.
You can't go down here to a Cal and cash a check on Gainesville Bank.
No, that's right.
You've got to have...
You can if you have a MasterCard.
Yeah, but they're not honoring your check. They're honoring your MasterCard. In other words, you're putting your MasterCard up as a sort of a guarantee.
That almost forces you to carry one. See, I don't like to carry one of those things.
One of those cards?
Uh-huh.
Well, if you don't... It all depends whether you use it much or not. I have gas company credit cards, but I don't use them because I like to have, I don't always buy at the same place all the time. So I buy everything on MasterCharge, and then I get one bill.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easier to just keep books with one bill than it is with a whole lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't that much trouble for me because I'm, the bookkeeper does it, but as long as I pay by check.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that if I were a lady and carried my purse on my arm, I think I'd carry credit card. I mean, I'd carry traveler's checks if I traveled, because they can lose a purse. But
mm-hmm.
when you got it in your hip pocket, buttoned most of the time, and your hand on it when you're in a crowd. In fact, if I'm in a crowd, I take my pocketbook out of my hip pocket and put it in my front pocket and put my hand in the pocket.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty hard for a hip pocket to get past your hand. Now, they can get in your pocket, I swear to God, from what I hear. I've never had it done, but they claim that you can have a good pickpocket.
Of course, in your hip pocket. They can't even.
Very easy. In fact, I've heard stories. They even can just put a razor blade over the bulge and it falls out. But that's it. Well, they work in pairs. You've seen it in the movies a lot, and I'm sure it.
Mm-hmm.
Sure it happened. But,
well, at least they've got to where they don't send you these credit cards without you asking for them.
Well, they've been credit cards have tightened up.
Now you have to apply for them, don't you?
Mm-hmm. I think you do.
Mm-hmm.
And these cut rate or discount gas stations, you know, don't take MasterCard anymore because they were losing too much. Well, it was either the cost, you know, the credit crunch in which they have to take something less than the cash price for sponsoring the credit, and so they. But I understand that part of that was came from the credit card companies and not the gas companies.
Mm-hmm.
That they were losing too much money on the kind of people that went to discount places.
Mm-hmm.
There was a piece this week in that Action Line column about the fellow that had his feelings hurt because he couldn't get a check cashed at Moss Brothers without a proper identification, and he thought it was collusion of some kind to force him to have a Moss Brothers charge account. And the manager that replied in rebuttal to this said that it wasn't so at all. All they want to know is that they can get in touch with the scoundrels if the check isn't any good. I think the most interesting thing on the credit card scene, though, is this suit to force people, or that is businesses that honor a credit card, to honor less than the cash price for cash. I mean, less than the stated price for cash.
Because
that's exactly what you're doing when you pay cash. You're pay the full price. You're subsidizing the cost of you're subsidizing the cost of the credit that's being offered to other people, because the seller accepts less than the stated price for the privilege of selling it to the fellow for on his credit card.
Sure, they have to be paid for, don't they?
Yeah.
I brought up a point with a telephone company. They had trouble with this telephone company up in this corner, seemingly too far from their center. Apparently, they don't have trouble with Macintosh that they have up here. Now, I'm not sure of that, but that's information I have. But they probably have too much trouble all over. Well, anyhow, I was up in West Virginia, and I couldn't get home. The line was out, and they were putting in a new line, and it was out for a week. And furthermore, it'd been off, been out off and on before that.
About 10 days.
And,
we didn't have telephone.
Then it would be out for 2 or 3 days, and if it came on Friday, it'd be out for the weekend. So I wrote the Public Utilities Commission and asked them when the company was out like that, didn't they have some responsibility in letting their customers know what was going on ahead of time? They planned it. And if it's going to be out that much, wouldn't they have some responsibility in cutting that? Would they just go ahead and charge them for that service that they never got? Well, the first thing I heard was the service man down here called me and asked me what complaint I had with the company. And I told him I didn't have any complaint with the company. I had written the Public Service Commissioner and asked for information. And I told them I was not writing as a complaint to the company. I was writing them for information. But what did they do, damn them? They just sent my letter automatically over to the company. Well, I thought that'd be the end of it. But then they also answered it 2 or 3 days later. And they quoted from the law and said that the under certain circumstances that the company would have to deduct those costs, but only at the request of the customer. So it's like what they say, you know, about the railroad commissioner. You see, he's there to regulate the railroad, but what he does in time, he gets to be an advocate of the railroad. You know what they say about those things. Well, the utilities commissioner of the state of Florida gets to be protect the telephone company and let them charge for time so they don't give you service.
Would you have guys?
Well, I hope you promptly asked for it.
Well, I tell you, there's so many things to ask for. I don't know whether I ever get around to it or not. Mm-hmm. It's like writing to Congressman. You see, you keep thinking about you go ahead and write him, and then the first thing you know, you got 2 or 3 things to write about, and then you get so many things to write about, you just give up.
You think Mary and Gilliland's going to have a chance against Sid Martin? I heard her say it wasn't anything she in it for her, and certainly wasn't going to help her husband. For her to be up there in Tallahassee. He's an obstetrician.
Well, I'm not qualified to speculate about who's going to win that kind of a race.
I have a bunch of cards for Mary, and I thought Florence had some.
My goodness, Florence had a stack. Well, she had a whole package of them about that high, and I think she must have addressed Scrittner 2/3 of the package. Must have. must have addressed 300-400 of them. And well, Barry Gilliland has got a lot of collected more money, I think, in contributions than he has.
Oh, really?
I'm just guessing at that from what I saw and what my recollection is in the paper. It's a great mystery to me, the headway that a professional politician gets. You know, the longer he's a politician, it seems like the more headway he makes.
Yeah.
Easier. And I don't know if it's notoriety or whether it's notoriety that prompts people to vote for him or whether they imbue confidence. They certainly, professional politician that imbues absolutely no confidence in me. I mean, there's nothing that I read as confidence. How could you be confident about a man like Gurney, for instance?
Mm-hmm.
See?
Yeah.
And I don't, and Don Fuquay doesn't imbue what I'd call confidence.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of you know, after everything's decided, then he decides that that's a good thing to be for, he talked to us at the medical center the medical society meeting here last winter, and it was absolutely inane. He didn't have a thing to say. It was that political BS, that mouthings that everybody's supposed to feel good when they get through. I've heard the same thing by lesser people, you know.
That's what keeps them in office, don't you know?
Yeah, and it's kind of a ridiculous system. Why I don't understand. That's what the mystery is. Why it succeeds, Gerald Ford is kind of refreshing. He kind of tells you, well, I got up and got my breakfast this morning. I'm going down to the office. Well, that's pretty real, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
Uh-huh. And he says it looks like there's a hard job here. I guess I better get to work, you know. And you got a feeling like he's a plain ordinary somebody. But the rest of these scoundrels is just in the court. I don't know whether I was noticed in the paper today, the Ocala paper, just filled with, goodness gracious, they've got more people running for office down there than you can shake a stick at. One of them down in the lower hand corner, I wouldn't even bother to remember his name. It's in big bold print, I'm not a politician. And I said, well, sorry for you then, because if you aren't worth a damn, you know, in the race, and if you get elected, you'll be a politician. So that's a mighty poor credibility to place your stand on the fact you're not a politician. I still feel bad because I voted for Nixon. I should talk about
that. Huh? Haunts you?
It haunts me a whole lot.
Yeah.
It just makes me mad almost to think that anybody could appear to be a better alternative at the time to turn out to be such a scoundrel.
Tom
Wicker
when the when Nixon was nominated, now that was his first term in office, he was so put out that he was almost sick. And the reason he was on those weekly programs then, on Channel 5, at the time we were watching a good bit, kept up with it.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, those fellas know so much more what goes on.
Emotion,
and
he
wasn't
supposed to.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Way back. I remember that.
You know, it was right sad. Partly, Nixon got in a huddle with himself to make decisions. And apparently that's the only way he could do it. And just the reverse is what they want.
Yeah. Yeah.
They want you to stand out there on the street corner and talk with the Secretary of State and two or three other people and make the decision. They want to see it open. Well, you know, if the sunshine law has got accepted to that extent, you just got to do it that way, haven't you?
Yeah.
Well.
Well, this is, of course, Max Lerner, I think, was the one who wrote it, summed it up just and reflected just what he said, mm-hmm. is that of course, Max, put it in that high-blown language,
mm-hmm.
that the problem arose when the reality of Nixon's self-interest conflicted with the unreality of his self-image.
Oh, yeah.
See? It really... Really tells it in the big, that's the big picture.
That's one of the best programs on.
Is it?
60 Minutes. Uh-huh.
I've never seen it, except maybe.
It's on Sunday night at 9:30 now.
What channel?
For National Conglomerates United.
Channel 4. No, we haven't got. We've never gotten Channel 4 since we moved to town.
Oh, really? Aren't you on cable?
Now, there's some programs I'd really like to watch.
But you would love that. You really would be if one of them.
Anything that fries is $10.
I miss those.
The great workhorse of Vietnam.
You know those,
piloted by the same man who flew them in and out of K-Town.
Stories of America by, Masterpiece Theater MC.
Yeah.
This ship cost the oil company $13,000.
He's a documentary. He's about
3 years old. 800 miles from Prudhoe Bay up on the Arctic Ocean to the port of Valdez in the south. The largest private construction project ever. $4.5 billion to get the crude flowing from the North Slope. The pipe is 4 feet wide, half inch thick steel, made, of course, in Japan. It's been lying here for years, waiting. The pipeline held up in court by environmentalists.
Bet the iron ore came from Australia. I bet the iron ore came from Australia. Don't you ever get them fixed?
I have tried once or twice, but they don't stay fixed.
Well, these have been real good. There's been no trouble tonight, for some time.
Well, this may be interference. Hmm? Is that aerial interference? You have an aerial? You must have an aerial.
Yeah. They tall one. Well, I'm surprised you don't have cable, Carl.
Well, it's not in the county. Yeah, or at least.
Oh, that's right. You're not in town.
Mm-hmm. And, somebody told us they could put an aerial up for us for $50, but I just not that interested in TV, and they're not that interested in having the kids have that much freedom of choice. We got two little portable sets that get channel 20 and channel 5, and we have one Zeta set. This one over here. In our bedroom, we get channel 5 on, and that's the extent of our.
When do the children start school?
Wednesday.
Wednesday, I thought it was Wednesday.
Wednesday?
Instead of Tuesday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good.
I think
it lasts.
Yeah. Well, summer's right. Over almost. Vacation is over. And
that's what I thought. I remember that. Mm-hmm.
Well, how did they figure that thing?
Well, for one reason, I think that's public schools too, isn't it? As well as teachers.
Well, I don't know what the public schools are or not.
I don't know. But anyway, assuming, you know, that if you get go away for the Labor Day weekend, it'll take you another day to get back or something like that.
But up at Val's first classes were on Thursday, and Carla's first classes were on Saturday, and she didn't get there for them. She called us Thursday night from she called us Friday morning. She arrived Thursday night in Atlanta and called us Thursday morning. She was staying at the home with the girl that went with her. And after this, Georgina and her father were going to drive them both to school on Saturday or Sunday, and she'd be there for. And I think they have classes on Labor Day tomorrow. She had a growing summer, she wrote us. She had a lot of misgivings. And
oh, really?
Little conflicts, the kind that young folks can have, I guess. She's still got some growing up to do. Dow shed a little tear when he left, which was good.
Oh, he did? That's Dow's one of my favorites.
He's come to our. Very interesting that he's had this quandary about what he thinks he might like to do, you know, when he had some counseling over. He had two counseling sessions. What were they? At school. What were they? At school? And then I guess. Well, that didn't really amount to too much, I guess, but they went. Went down to Eckerd College, where the Presbyterians have a session several times a year, and spent two and a half days or something down there. And it was really very revealing for him, I think. Kind of helped him to personal contact with the counselors were very helpful. And the other was that they take so many tests that the same material keeps coming back that they begin to get a reflection of themselves, you know, aided by the personal contact with the counselors. And he came back with a little insight to his, you know, total picture, you know, what he is and how it results from being, I guess. I don't know how deep it goes, but he blossomed almost instantly after that little contact. That was the other counseling sessions he had were at in July when we went up to Jefferson City too. That was 2 days, which was they call orientation of the freshmen, but it actually is a combined orientation and counseling session in which they take several tests. He didn't tell us too much about it, but just before he left, Lawrence might have told you about it. She was called to jury duty, and while they were interviewing the prospective jurors to find out who they are and what they do, and she identified one of the men was a professor from the building trades, head of the building trades, name's Halpern, I think. Halpern. And so she introduced herself, and he volunteered to, interview with Dow. So Dow went out just a week ago. Monday. The Monday before he left. And sort of what the building trades college or school has to offer is seems to be just what Dow's interested in.
Oh, really?
And it all kind of just began to fit together, and he just hadn't been able to focus on anything specific, and by the time he'd left on Saturday, he'd already turned this over enough that this is just exactly what he'd like to do.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, of course, all coincidence in the spirit. And he can get all of the first 2 years that most of everything he would take in 2 years at Carson Newman will qualify for the basics in the School of Building Trades, except one course in building materials is all that he might could pick up either a summer or something. He didn't say he could, but he could pick it up. But what Dow likes about it most is that all of those stultifying requirements like language and philosophy and things are not required for a degree in building trades. They concentrate on the mechanics and science and math. Of course, he's a little weak in math, but he thinks he can buckle down if he has an objective. And that he can get a degree with a minimum of those liberal arts subjects, most of which can be achieved at Carson Newman. So it really sparked him up.
Yeah.
I think it'll probably give him a little foundation that he, a little inspiration that he did not have to get to work on the academics of the of the first 2 years. Very also very interesting was that when we were in Jefferson City in Florence. Was there, you know, she flew up and we were there together, that we driving around Jefferson City and we noticed a very quaint antique shop. Couldn't have been any bigger than, you know, these two rooms square. It wasn't as big as the ground floor in this house. It did have a second story, and William and Mary and antiques, and we went in and the owners were not there, but it was under the care of an elderly gentleman who worked in the diplomatic corps and was retired. His name was Larson, but he was, a Russian Jew that had migrated. No telling what his name was. But he'd had a son who graduated from Carson Newman, and he had come home to Jefferson City to retire. And he was very friendly and, you know, got acquainted right away and invited now to come down and talk to him. It's only two blocks from the school, you know. Just one of those nice potential associations. And while he was there, he told Al, he says, if you just study that religion course, he says, if you can get a good grade in that religion course, he says, you can pass anything they got out there. That was the one course that Al wasn't particularly interested in. But all the freshmen get signed up for it. Well, he signed up for religion, history, English, math, and science. He's got five courses right off the bat. One of which is this religion course. That if he can concentrate on that, he can do anything. Carson did. So he has that nice old gent to.
Yeah, go in and talk, and then
Dad
just might talk with
you. Yeah, I think Dad would. Yeah, in fact, I'm sure he would. Dad has a strong affection for, like, you know, Tuckmac, you know, and I think he can translate. He might be able to translate that little quiet affection for him. So I think there's just a lot of potential up there. I think, of course, what I've tried to help him appreciate it without talking too much about it is the advantage of getting out of town. You know, he wanted to stay and go to the community college and live at home under mother's roof.
That's right.
Yeah. So without push him out. We only kind of let him out.
You know, you've got a curious combination.
The building trades courses won't make him very interesting. They may equip him and all like that, but they won't. Bob Sterling faced that. He was an engineer at Sperry and was doing well. And he never talked about it. It's just come up every now and then. But I figured that he read, he was a churchman too. I figured he read Schweitzer. And Schweitzer sort of took root in him. And he gave up that Sperry business.
Atlanta.
Huh?
He went to Atlanta. I know him. He sat in my chair and told me before he left.
Oh, you know Bob?
Yeah.
What did he tell you?
Well, I don't remember what he told me, excepting that he was leaving the university. I thought he was a teacher. I thought he was a teacher at the time in the engineering department.
No,
really,
he was at Sperry.
He quit and he went to the seminary.
He was one of the big shots at Sperry, and he was really way up there.
Well, he was.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, he traveled all over the country.
He was right.
Made money and everything.
Right, confident fellow. Right person. Well, he took 3 years and studied Old Testament Greek and things like that. And he talked about it out here one time, but somehow or other, he didn't want to talk about it, and we didn't stay on it very long. But I got the idea that the hardest thing for him was that he had been conditioned, you see, to engineering subjects, and here he was in the humanities. And it was hard for him. And of course, when he finished it, he came down here and was going to get an assignment. That didn't work out, so he even quit going to church. He was teaching school in the community college. Well, he's still a right comfort fella, but it's the balance there. And what I've noticed, he picks up what he talks about on the personal side. He doesn't talk science to me, see. But when he talks about students, what he talks about, I'd call psychology. That, yeah, this young fella was just way down his grades. And then his daddy got him a pony, a clarinet, or a kettle drum.
Mm-hmm.
And that got him in the band, and that got him in with the band people, and that got him out with the marching people, and that got him out in the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's his interest in psychology. And it's a formula that's not very interesting. You can reduce anything to very small proportions with a psychology of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
And you actually never get into cases. And I don't think he is capable of relating to you what happened in that detour of his where he was following Schweitzer.
Well, I'll tell you what he told me, because now I remember it. He summed it up very briefly. He said he discovered that for himself, he found that what he could do most effectively, he could do at arm's length, better than from the pulpit. That's after he came back.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
See.
Uh-huh.
So you see that turning your statement around is that he as an individual or as a person, he feels more effective. Whatever he does, he feels more effective operating in that very small dimension that you spoke about.
Yes, but he's mm-hmm. going to reduce everything to that small statement. And you won't have anything there that's very interesting.
Well,
now
he didn't have anything more to say beyond that.
He,
you know, I mean, in
yeah.
a sense.
I don't think he will. That's what I was saying to you. I think with
mm-hmm.
his mentality, he's incapable of actually bringing to life the experience that he had. Walking in Schweitzer's footsteps.
He didn't walk long enough.
Well, he's building trades won't get you there. Now, what will get you there, I don't know.
Well, I think I think you're I sympathize with your point of view from my own personal experience. Okay.
I'm not,
I know what you're saying.
I know what Asian people say, okay. But I'm just saying that they're excellent to a degree.
Ah, but you see, that's right. But for a person, for a person who has not yet found the path, you see, by themselves, will not find it. See, that an individual is for their own salvation is better to fix on something they can be satisfied with in the context of what they can identify will satisfy them.
Living with doubt is one of the things that makes you.
You know, I don't know those philosophical questions. I always have to reduce them to my own experience. And I can say that I lived and I'm just trying to intellectualize this a little, is that I lived with doubt for years and years and years and years. But I've made the transition from everything being a doubt to everything is reasonably, I don't say certain, but that I live with the unknowable thing. If you see the transition between things that you doubt about whether they're right to the fact that you now live day to day with a lot of things that you might used to have doubted, but you now know they're unknowable. Now, I think that this is the part that young people can't cope with, is this. They want, and we may have talked about it before then, and a lot of people talk about this in teaching young people, is they always want pat answers. Mm-hmm. This as you say, they feel uncomfortable, and this is the antithesis of, I guess, of the doubt, is that they don't want any doubt. They want certainty.
Especially with someone like Dow, who's feels that he's not Carla.
Yeah. But you see, people like Carla, though, have pain. This is what she's talking about this summer. The letters that came were just painful. She hardly had a pleasurable experience because there was always something that wasn't there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Or she was always had a shortcoming with respect to either her talent or her interpersonal relationship, her ability to respond in a certain way, and it was painful, and it ought to have been just beautiful, see?
Mm-hmm.
It ought to have been wonderful, and it wasn't. It was painful. Just all summer was painful.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was, she said something.
You keep the letters?
Oh, yes.
You
I
file
Florence,
them?
Well, I think Florence does.
File them, and as you get them, file them and clip them on a piece of paper and write on that piece of paper what the situation is.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you go back to read them, you can reconstruct them.
Florence. But Carla said, and just I was just getting about to walk out the door of the office. It was getting late. So Carla said hello to me, and I only had time to say hello. And she said, "I want you to know I appreciate you." She just got back. So maybe all that stuff you've been trying to be patient with, she's seeing, and this of course is just part of that growing. And that she's speaking of what a little thought came to mind that Carla's one of her consternation is how she's going to effectively be an artist, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how, but she was having this difficulty this summer in rendering anything, you know. She just couldn't. The instruction was very poor, and they apparently expected her to be able to demonstrate on paper or canvas things that she doesn't know, apparently, or hasn't, at least hasn't had enough experience yet. And she didn't get any help, and it was pretty terrible. But she said that one of the girls that, actually, it was one of the girls that was in the course who recognized its limitations, who just, she was far superior to the course, so she just quit. Her name was Charlotte, so, and but she stayed in the environs there and studied on her own, and Carla and her friend visited her, Charlotte, and Charlotte reassured her that if she would, if she would get competent in a medium, in the handling of the materials, that the art would come, you see. Which is an interesting, she's also the one that had told Carla to learn to do something well, and it would make you free, see, make you independent. So that's the kind of thing she's been exposed to. Now, that you see, what you talked about Dao and how building trade will limit him is exactly the reason that we're trying to send him away to school, is for him to discover that he hasn't enlarged his, you know, perspective, intellectual perspective. By beyond that is his spiritual perspective. He hasn't any comprehension. He's so narrow. It's a sin. It's just absolutely, it's hard to imagine how a young fella, 18 years of age, in a free society, in an academic community like PK, could already be so rigid and so narrow, and yet he even wrote a paper. This is my philosophy, and it's a beautiful thing, you know, on paper. And he believes in Christianity, and he believes in the integrity of the self and the responsibility the individual has to himself and all these stuffs he's been taught, and he can tell you, and he thinks he believes it, and he says, damn rigid, he don't want to learn anything else, see? He don't want to learn anything else. He just wants to have something to do.
You know, they
huh? Yeah.
Did you ever notice chaps, I notice them when they they're afraid of.
Yeah, they don't want to get shook up.
You ever notice that?
Yeah.
I can't feel that Dad would be like that, being belonging to you and Tom.
That's what disappoints me. That's what disappoints me. But this only means that each individual has got to go out and find it for himself. And the answer is that if he went to the community college,
You don't find
it. He won't find it. Living at home, I don't know whether you'd find it at the community college if you didn't live at home. But we got an example of a fellow in the back, John Haney's son, is incompetent. He's 35 years of age, and he's incompetent, and he's never lived anywhere but home. Still living at home. Rides his motorcycle off, and wheels back in. And mother sets him out crackers and milk, you know? 35 years of age. Well, how are they ever going to grow up? In fact, instead of giving Dow a car and a damn college education, put $5 in his pocket and kick him out the door, and he'd probably amount to more.
Yeah. Well.
Well, that, I mean, you said it slightly, but actually, you know, it might be.
I'm in my 50s, and I've only just woke up about 3-4 years ago and discovered that I'd, you know, kind of just about, I don't say I'm over the hump, but I just kind of almost can see over the hill. And it's,
well, you got a long ways to go.
That's right.
Carl, I'm older than that, and I haven't even been able to get up the hill yet.
Well, I don't say I'm over, I'm just...
tell you.
That's just that's what's so fascinating about this fellow. Well, I'm saying fascinating, but interesting at least, is this secondhand dealer down here, Grover Phillips. Now, he is just some kind of a character, and all he represents is human experience. He has had, he can't be as old as I am. He talks the things he's done before World War I makes it sound like he might be past 60, but he's can't be a little bit. He must be near 50, but he's. He just has had so darn much experience and crammed into a reasonable existence. And that's not a great, enormous philosophical thing, but the constant interplay that he's had with people in dealing in barter is just.
You mean he's made something of it?
No, no, he hadn't made a thing out of it. He'd he hasn't made it, except as he appears to you and appears as a individual. He is a individual.
And this that's what he means.
Yeah.
He's made something.
Yeah, he's made an individual of himself.
He's
talked
to you.
Yeah.
So what happened?
Yeah.
And
oh,
the people
endlessly.
Come in.
Just endlessly. See.
Now where is he,
Carl? He's in McIntosh down there. Where Jim Hall used to be, down in the old auction furniture and auction signs, been down there for years. Just
yeah.
In the
right next to the new store.
Oh, he's in Manhattan.
No, he's in Orange Lake.
Oh, that's right.
Where
the auction is.
Where the auction is, where Jim Hall, who's next to in McIntosh, next to the hardware store, used to be.
Oh, this is the auctioneer man.
Yeah.
The place
is the
auctioneer.
Yeah, this is Philip Grover, the auctioneer, and he is.
Philip Grover.
And he can talk.
Oh, he can talk and talk and talk. Just he told us the funniest story today about. I wouldn't attempt to repeat the story, but the context of the story was about the drug.
Don't summarize it, God damn it! I'm tired of all them summaries.
Well, I'm not a storyteller.
I'm not.
All right.
Go on,
Carl. Okay, you're gonna miss it.
All right. All these summaries get.
I thought really, now you see I misinterpreted the situation. I thought that's what he would like would be just the summary, the shortest insight into the kind of story that the man. I'm not going to tell you the story. I'm going to tell you the kind of story he tells.
Just give me the story.
Well, it started off with some kind of a comment about so silly.
Well, we get him up
here
sometime.
Oh, no, you won't get him up here. You have to find him in his natural habitat. And just go down and just.
That's what you do.
Hmm? Yeah,
that's what you do.
Yeah, just go down and rummage around, and he knows me. Tell that story about. I'm going to summarize that. I'm not going to. Well, no.
It's an ignorant guy.
No?
Go ahead and
go ahead.
Talk to him.
Well, he tells about those Tennessee fellas that could run, you know, and he tells that story about the fellow that could outrun anything. Barefooted across those fences and fields, and he just tells that story. He's the one that finally got caught by the sheriff because somebody tipped off the sheriff that he would be getting out the hideaway, and the hideaway was a sluice underneath the cabin door, and he got underneath the cabin, you know, the door, and got into this sluice, and which was a tin pipe, quite a distance that. Dumped down into the river, the sheriff was waiting for him. When he got down at the bottom of it. Oh, the way he tells it.
But he knows the people that come in and trade around with him and see them and talk to him.
Well, no, he doesn't talk to him too much. Well, you have to. No, he uses his experience to better himself. He reads people. He can tell you who's going to buy and who isn't. He can tell you whether they're going to come back.
Oh, that's
right. Yeah. And if you look like you're too cheap and aren't going to buy anything, he just puts the price high and gets you out of the store.
Oh.
And that sort of thing.
Have to what?
Yeah. He just knows people so well that it's just, it's kind of.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Tennessee hillbilly from Lenore.
Well,
that area?
Not open, yeah.
Hmm?
But he's not open, but just every once in a while, is it? Just on weekends?
Well, David Dedrick asked him, when you when are you open? And he said, why don't you ask me when I'm closed?
Oh, I didn't realize that he was there.
Apparently there a fair share of the time.
Uh-huh.
Well, you missed a great story about the fellow that had two... You missed a great story about the fellow that had both feet shot off. And his wife used to hide his feet when he got drunk. So he could...
Oh,
well, see, it isn't the same if I tell it.
That sounds like some loving good. He's an old East Tennessee yarn spinner from a century ago.
Yeah.
And he's screwball. You know, he tells things like that. And good. I love to read one or two of those loving good stories and just get them in mind. I didn't realize at the time I was first exposed to them that you'd have to hear them in order to sort of come to mind. You gotta hear them.
Mm-hmm.
And they live in those stories, don't they?
Yeah.
And it means it means so much to them.
Well, David and his daddy do the same thing, don't they?
Yeah, pretty much. Not they do similar, but they're not quite as loquacious, and they're not quite as spontaneous. But even the old granddad, David's father, I've been around him enough. He'll spin a story once in a while. Well, I've thought several times I'd go make a few notes just for the coincidence of some of the things that he tells about. His are mostly related to those Negro gangs that used to work on the roads and the machinery and how they camp and
Well, that's it. If you get to listen to them a little bit, you sort of get the hang of it.
Well, did Florence tell you that a young man wants to come and say hello to you? Anyway, his name is Bob Ellington.
She mentioned him, yes.
His wife's a school teacher, and she's got a master's degree, and he's working towards his master's. He's going to get his in journalism, he says. I just told me. And in fact, he said that Labor Day might be free. Apparently his wife, well, if you're young, married, and got obligations, you can. I said, what are you doing last week or something? Oh, I had to go to Tampa. His wife's sister's friend got married or some damn thing. You know, didn't sound very consequential to me, but he just couldn't make it. But met another boy at school. Well, I remember what I told a girl once when she asked proposed marriage to me, and I said, well, I'm not what I want to be yet. Well, that long road up, you know? That was some place about where I was making that transition between being a tradesman and being something else. That transition was really 4 years in the service, you know, where I didn't really accomplish very much.
Why?
That transition from being a perpetual tradesman to something else was 4 years in the service.
What service?
Military service.
Which
part? Well, as an enlisted man from 1942 to 46.
Doing what?
Being a medical corpsman in a stateside hospital as a dispensary aide.
Yeah.
Well, I was a ward orderly for a little while and a surgical operating room technician for a little while, and then the rest of the time what we call a surgical technician in a dispensary.
Yeah.
Gosh, if I could have known how much one could have bettered oneself, you know, if it had any kind of intellectual experience prior to that, I could have used all that time to some kind of furtherance of the result, but most of it was dead reflection in the room.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say it was wasted, but it was not very productive.
Yeah, it's awful easy to get sort of lost.
But at least you made a transition.
Yeah, motivated by doubt. Yeah, a medical officer said I was expressing my doubt, and even in fact I was already discharged from the service, and I was about to enter school or trying to decide to, and had actually had planned to go to the University of California at Berkeley, and I actually went there and registered. Virtually registered. And I was there 30 days ahead to get located, and I had so many quandaries and began to have some doubts, especially when a friend of mine who had been my first sergeant in that detachment was already there, and he says there's only 5,000 students enrolling in the liberal arts college. And he said 4,000 of them want to be doctors. I went back to Portland, Oregon, where my uncle lived and where I had been in the service, and went and talked to one of the doctors that I'd worked under, and says, I don't think you want to be a doctor very bad.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I needed.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody to tell me I didn't want to be.
So you
that
be.
Was January. That was March. That was February or March. Well, that was February of 1946, and I'd just been out of service 2 months, and didn't graduate from medical school until 1953.
Well, I know, Carl, but you see, in your position, you see, doubt wouldn't be an element, really, because, you see, you had to be enterprising to get anywhere at all, as much as they put you through. And once you're enterprising, it's like being a county agent, you see. You don't look on one side or the other. You see, what you're doing, you're pushing programs. You've got the red
getting through
program, you see, and
yeah.
The 4-H program,
yeah.
And all those things. And you don't see the people. You're just pushing programs. And you have to be that way, I think, in the field that you came up in. There's just so much of it. You actually, your mind is never free enough to doubt.
Well, that's really what happens afterwards. After you get that one fixation, there's there really isn't any time for that. You don't. What happened was, I can remember after I got accepted in medical school, it dawned on me, what in the devil would I have done if I hadn't gotten accepted in medical school? I was absolutely prepared for nothing else.
Uh-huh.
In spite of a major in chemistry and good grades and a good good academic record, I wasn't prepared to, well, you weren't prepared intellectually, I mean emotionally, to be anything else.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You focus it then.
Well, I don't know.
So I don't.
And then, you see, when you get out, you go from one thing to another, and there's always something ahead of you that just absorbs you, and it's absorbing. And you may dance around and do a little, be a little light-hearted on the side, but it's just very little.
just got too much, there's just too much going on. That's all there is to it. And it looks to me like that's one of the, that's a price that a professional person, I mean a real professional person, pays now. You see, everything he does is rewarding, you see, and it's worth doing, and it's appreciated, and all. But then it cuts him out of it so much. Well, he don't want to be cut out of anything. Well, you see, they're just not willing to pay the price. I mean, you've got to pay the price. You just don't have the energy and the time and all like that, you see. Hell, you can't do that with all that organization that you...
I think it's amazing that Carl has, you know, these outside things that he does do.
Well, the answer is you almost have to have something, because you can't do that professional stuff all the time. What's interesting to me is that everything I want to do on the outside is big. See, I want a big pickup truck, and I want a boom on it, and I want to I want somebody to give me. I'm dickering for 3 pieces of iron, 8 feet long, and this big I-beams that I want to haul home myself and have somebody weld together, and we got a forge and big tools, and we go to Tennessee and cut down a big tree, and we brought home the lumber. We cut the tree down in January, and we went back this summer and got the lumber that was cut, and we got it on the rack and in the shop. And because the things I work with all day are minuscule.
Oh, that's fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We do the complete cataract operation in a space this big, you know. Put 10 stitches in it, 12 stitches, 16 stitches.
Mm-hmm.
Under a microscope now. Going to California, Los Angeles, in the end of September, 20th of September, I believe. Take a 3-day course in the new cataract operation.
Let me ask you, what is this, since you mentioned it, what is this that Ralph was talking about, one of his friends had? Some sort of drop of medication or something instead of surgery for cataract?
No, there's no such thing as that.
Well, what is it? I'm not saying it right. But it's something other than surgery.
Well, there isn't anything. If we're talking about the same thing, it is surgery, and it's done with the aid of a very complicated machine. It is a cutting operation,
yeah.
And then the cataract is dissolved by a... It doesn't really dissolve. It's fragmented and sucked out of the eye.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm going to learn to do. I've already done it on cats.
Well, he has 3 friends that's had this done.
Who's this patient?
My brother-in-law, Elder Curry.
Oh.
And also.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just...
Where did he have it done?
I don't know. He hadn't had it, but he's had 3
friends.
Yeah.
Well, we're not sure that there are very many people doing this, but the prominent people are in New York and
mm-hmm.
over in Iowa somewhere. Somebody in Iowa is.
I believe these were done in New York.
Yeah.
And LF was just saying that it was so... these people felt it was
complications.
They hadn't had complications.
You say they had?
Had not had.
Had not had.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, that's...
But this is new. And this is what you're going to see back.
We have one of the instruments at North Florida Hospital, and I've used it on cats. So I'm not exactly a stranger to the instrument, but you have to go and take the course to qualify for the privilege in the hospital.
And you're not quite sure it's the thing to do.
Well, it has lots. It has limitations.
Yeah.
And it has some hazards, and
mm-hmm.
it's not for every patient, and it's
mm-hmm.
Also very technically difficult. the only place you can get real experience is doing it on people, and you have to be prepared for some failures and complications and hard work and misery and doubt. Going through the, you're just going through the cycle again. But that's the growth cycle, you see. Product of our expanding universe.
Well, in such a short time since I had this detachment, they kept me down there 10 days. And then in 2 years later, they kept me down there a week. And 2 years later, they said, do you want to stay overnight? Why don't you just have it done outside? That was that.
We're sending around. I'm sending, I don't know what percentage of my patients, but I'm sending them home a day after the operation from the conventional operation. No, for a cataract operation, the conventional operation where you make a large incision and take it out in the conventional way.
And send them home.